Continental Consolidated Companies Incorporated versus University Savings Association and Petrolife Incorporated. In each case, we've allowed 30 minutes oral argument for petitioners, 30 minutes for respondents, and 15 minutes for rebuttal, and we trust that the various petitioners and respondents have worked out the allocation of their time.
May I please report Mr. David East and Ms. Susan Green to present argument for petitioners. Mr. David East will open.
May it please the Court, I am David East, Professor of Commercial Law and Associate Dean at South Texas College of Law. I am also consulting counsel with Walt Squires and Tompkins, representing University Savings Association and Petrolife Inc. These two entities were respondents originally in this court because we prevailed in the Court of Appeals. We were realigned as petitioners for purposes of this argument, so with the Court's permission, I'm going to refer to us as petitioners. I'm joined this morning by Ms. Susan Greenberg, who will argue on behalf of the petitioner Guaranty Federal Savings Bank, and I'll just refer to all of us as petitioners during the course of the argument. Now, I will talk about teller's checks and stopping payment on teller's checks. Ms. Greenberg will discuss gambling, fraud, and other defenses which we believe have been more than adequately established for purposes of avoiding the summary judgments which were granted below. Here are the similar facts of these cases. Both savings associations drew teller's checks at the request of their depositors and made them payable to the respondents. Being teller's checks, these checks were drawn on another bank as the drawee. University drew its check on the Federal Home Loan Bank of Little Rock. Guaranty Federal drew a check on Citibank of New York. Our depositors as remitters then requested us to stop payment on these tellers' checks, informing us of defenses to their payment. In the University Savings case, Petrolife informed us that it had been defrauded out of the check by the fraud of Intercontinental Consolidated Companies, who had made misrepresentations, never gave value, but then wanted a $2 million windfall. Guaranty Federal's remitter, it turns out, gave their check to Horseshoe in an illegal gambling transaction. We honored our depositor remitter's request to stop payment by asking the drawees not to pay these checks, and they were not paid, and we were then sued by ICC and Horseshoe. In the University Savings case, our remitter, Petrolife, intervened to assert its own claims and defenses and to defend us, University Savings. Both trial courts granted summary judgment against the petitioner savings and loans, holding that payment could not be stopped on teller's checks. Now, Your Honors, I want to discuss three points. First, that the Uniform Commercial Code clearly permits the petitioner savings and loans to stop payment on their teller's checks. Second, that stopping payment does not stop liability, but permits the savings associations to raise defenses to liability, including those of our remitters. And third, that the concept of cash equivalency should not be applied to teller's checks to contradict the clear law of the UCC. All agree that the Uniform Commercial Code is the governing law here. The Federal Home Loan Bank Board, in fact, has ruled that the UCC applies to federal home loan banks. That ruling is in 12 CFR at Part 534.7. In that same CFR, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board has ruled that federal home loan banks are banks for purposes of the UCC's definition. And indeed, federal statutes permit these banks to act just like banks, take deposits and engage in other banking activities. Now, Your Honors, Section 4403 of the Uniform Commercial Code confers on the customer the right to stop payment on checks drawn on their account.
What difference does that make in this case when the drawee is not sued?
Your Honor, the difference is this. The petitioner savings and loans are the customers of the banks on which they drew these checks. Our petitioners are customers, respectively, of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Little Rock and of Citibank of New York.
So the stop payment order is a directive to the drawee bank not to pay the item.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But nobody is claiming that the drawee should have paid the item in either of these cases.
Well, Your Honor, the drawees could, if they had chosen for whatever reason, not have paid the checks, although, as we all know, it's the normal experience for drawee banks to pay checks when they are properly presented.
But the plaintiffs in these cases are not claiming against the drawees. So what difference does the stop payment order make?
Well, Your Honor, the respondents have asserted that we had no right to ask the Federal Home Loan Bank and to ask the Citibank to stop payment on these checks. My point is that being customers, we had every right to ask them under the code to stop payment on these.
Well, maybe you did and maybe you didn't, but what difference does it make if the drawee is not sued?
Well,
what difference does it make whether you did do it or you didn't do it or you had the right or you didn't have the right, since no one is claiming against the drawee?
Your client seems to owe the money or they don't owe it, so claiming against the drawee bank is inconsequential, isn't it?
Well, it is true that the drawee banks have not been sued, but that's basically irrelevant to the case to the case before the court. The drawee banks had no liability merely because checks were drawn on them. They themselves would have had the option to pay or not to pay. And the fact that they're not present is basically irrelevant to our petitioner's rights to ask them not to pay.
Well, they had the duty to pay it, didn't they, under the code, unless they had some excuse for non-payment.
No, Your Honor. I believe that is not correct under the code. Now, that is what respondents would suggest, but the drawee bank does not have a duty to others to pay the checks. The drawee is never liable until the drawee accepts the check, indicates somehow on the check that the drawee agrees to pay the check or just goes ahead and pays it. The drawee is not liable before that time, and this is clear in Code Sections 3409 and 3410, that these drawees had no obligation to the holders to pay these checks.
Isn't the drawer's liability on these instruments completely independent of whether it did or did not issue a stop payment order?
That much is correct, Your Honor. The drawer's petitioners have made a contract, the drawer's contract, on these instruments. And we have been sued on those drawer's contracts.
So then what difference does it make that you did or didn't stop payment?
In that context, it doesn't, Your Honor. But the argument has been made that we didn't even have a right to do that.
Well, aren't we arguing, what I'm suggesting to you is, aren't we arguing about something that is irrelevant in this case, because the real issue is, are the drawers liable on these instruments, not can they stop payment?
I've always thought that was a real issue, Your Honor. In fact, I have always thought that framing it in terms of stopping payment avoids the real issue. The real issue is, what defenses can we raise when we stop payment?
Well, can't you raise the same issues whether you stop payment or not?
Well, if the instrument is paid by the drawee banks when presented, Your Honor, then we would have a different situation.
I understand that, but even for whatever reason, there's no claim made against the drawee. Whether the drawer is liable or not doesn't depend upon the stop payment.
It does not depend upon the stop payment order, Your Honor. The real issue is the raising of these defenses, which we believe we adequately raised to avoid a summary judgment. Defenses to our contract as drawers. These defenses are provided for in Code Sections 3305, 3306, and 3307. The meaning of these sections clearly is that we and our remitters do have the chance to come in and present contract defenses, and that Petrolife, as the intervener, has the right to come in and assert on our behalf, as it did, its claims and defenses to this check. And that's exactly what they did. Now, Your Honor, this notion can't be overcome by some notion of cash equivalency, a non-code concept exemplified by some older and one pre-code New York case, that somehow it's the public's opinion that these teller's checks are going to be paid, and therefore that stopping payment's going to benefit commerce. Commerce is going to benefit where fraud is prevented. Commerce will benefit where illegal transactions are prevented. Recent New York cases, in fact, have brought their jurisprudence back into line with this code-based analysis. And this court, this honorable Supreme Court, has supported our position in its rationale in Wirtz against Richardson Heights Bank and Trust, when this court ruled that payment could not be stopped on a cashier's check. The rationale there clearly affords a distinction between that case and this one. On a cashier's check, the drawer and the drawee are the same. And therefore, this court ruled that the Richardson Heights Bank had accepted the check on issuance and believed it was therefore too late to stop payment after the acceptance. On a teller's check, the drawer and the drawee are not the same, and the drawer therefore does not accept the check on issuance. The acceptance is the act of the drawee, and as Justice Hext and I have already discussed, these drawees have not done anything to accept these checks. So the rationale in Wirtz basically indicates that that our petitioners, as the drawers, have done nothing to accept these checks, and the real issue is the defenses which we believe we've established and ought to have a chance to try in a trial rather than being poured out on a summary judgment. Now, in the couple of minutes I believe I have remaining, Your Honor, I want to take just a second. And I want to suggest some policy reasons why we believe that the way we suggest is the best way to decide this case. The code has a full set of procedures to handle these, with the stopping of payment, then the raising of the defenses under 3305 and 3306, and if you follow the code's scheme on this, multiple lawsuits are eliminated. We get the intervener, Petrolife, in here. We try all of the claims at the same time. Parties who perform on legal underlying obligations will get to recover under the code scheme. Parties who did not perform on underlying obligations, or as to whom the underlying obligation was illegal, will not recover because we'll be able to establish those defenses. Unearned windfalls will be prevented. Let me leave you at this point with a quote from the Hotel Riviera case, which has been cited by respondents. It is that no one should profit from a fraudulent act. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll now defer to Ms. Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. East. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Susan Greenberg. I'm with the law firm of Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Howard & Feld, and I represent the petitioner, Guaranty Federal Savings Bank. I want to address three issues this morning. The first concerns the scope of available defenses on checks like these, particularly the illegality defense. The second concerns the order of severance entered by the trial court. And the third concerns the fact that neither of the respondents have met their burdens on summary judgment below. Very briefly, the important facts of this case are that Guaranty Federal issued its teller's check at the request of its customer, Alan Parman, payable to Binnen and Company. Mr. Parman and some compatriots flew to Las Vegas, exchanged that check for $900,000 worth of chips at the Horseshoe Casino, which they proceeded to lose playing 21 in the space of 3 or 4 hours. When Guaranty Federal found out the next day that the consideration that it had received for its teller's check was worthless, it ordered Citibank to stop payment on the check, which Citibank did. After the check was dishonored, the Horseshoe Operating Company sued Guaranty Federal on its drawer's contract, and Guaranty Federal filed a third-party action against Mr. Parmet and others for indemnity. Mr. Eats' argument established that based on a sound and comprehensive reading of the entire Uniform Commercial Code on these issues, Guaranty Federal was allowed to stop payment on that teller's check, and it could thereafter raise available defenses. Those available defenses are my first subject. Under Section 3305 and 3306 of the Code, a party can raise defenses against the holder of an instrument. Whether those defenses will ultimately prevail or not depends in part on who is raising them and also on the character of the plaintiff. If the defendant raises the defenses of a third person, he, in most cases, cannot prevail unless that third person is willing to come in and assume the defense, which is what Petrolife tried to do in the trial court. And because Petrolife raised genuine issues of fact on its defenses of fraud and no consideration, it should not have suffered summary judgment there. If the party holding the check is a holder in due course, his claim will be subject to the so-called real defenses of Section 3305B of the Code. Assuming for a moment that Horseshoe is a holder in due course, which we don't concede and which I'll discuss later, Guaranty Federal could successfully raise the defense of illegality against the Horseshoe because illegality is one of the real defenses listed in the Code, which defeats the holder in due course. Guaranty Federal not only raised that defense, it was proven as a matter of law. Because the transaction in which the Horseshoe acquired the check was a gambling transaction and was illegal under Texas law, that check is unenforceable here against Guaranty Federal. Now, ICC and Horseshoe as respondents would have the court believe that to allow any defenses at all to be raised to checks like this would somehow wreak havoc on the commercial world. One, there's no proof of that. And two, it's simply not the case. What would interrupt the smooth running of commercial operations would be the non-enforcement of a very plain governing statute, the Uniform Commercial Code. That code clearly allows both Guaranty Federal and University and Petrolife to raise our defenses and to have them adjudicated. Those defenses are allowed to us by the code, and the respondents, by asking the court to render judgment for them, are really asking the court to strip us of defenses that are allowed to us. If the court were to accept the Horseshoe suggestion in one instance, it would not only eradicate the illegality defense, logically it would also render all of the other real defenses without force. What they in effect want is for the courts to rewrite very plain statutory law by judicial fiat. The effect of that would certainly not be to settle the commercial law of this state and make it uniform. The effect of that, because it ignores the code-based analysis that Mr. East spoke about, would be to make the commercial law of the state utterly unpredictable. On the other hand, enforcing the code, including the illegality defense, is nothing more than enforcement of a valid and constitutional legislative scheme, and that scheme is moored in very perfectly permissible legislative policies. If one of those policies is to exclude Las Vegas casinos from trying to use the judicial machinery of our state to enforce their gambling debts, the Horseshoe is not in a position to ask this court to ignore that policy and that law.
Why isn't there an estoppel in this case? Because the casino called the savings and loan and asked them about the check, and the savings and loan responded to the fact that it would be honored.
Well, Your Honor, I must say that I think that the record does not reflect that that's what happened. Viewing this case from the perspective that we were non-movements on the Horseshoe's motion for summary judgment, the evidence has to be taken in the light most favorable to us, and the record was on behalf of the officers at Guaranty Federal, not that the check would be honored, but simply that it had been issued, which was in fact the true case. The Horseshoe, on the other hand, contended that the folks at Guaranty Federal on the telephone said to them that the check is good, the funds are here, and words to that effect. And I believe that, under summary judgment law, our version of those facts has to be taken as true here. As to the estoppel question, I think that there isn't an estoppel, partly because there isn't one provided in the code, and there isn't one provided in any of the cases discussing the illegality defense. All of those Texas cases apply that defense with one voice, and there isn't any question about who was at fault or who did something wrong in issuing the check. It's merely a matter of looking at the facts that somebody gambled with the proceeds of that check, and the person on the other side of the gambling transaction should not be allowed to recover on it for that simple reason. As far as the substance of the illegality defense is concerned, as I say, there are many cases on that point. And the law of Texas is very clear on it. All of those cases and arguments concerning them are treated very comprehensively in the briefs on this case. And unless the court has any further questions about the substance of the illegality defense, I would refer it to our briefs.
What does official check mean on the top of the guaranteed federal savings and loan check? It says official check.
I don't think it means anything, Your Honor. If you look at the code, it doesn't mean anything. It's a name that's given to the check by the association for whatever reason it may have, and there isn't any evidence in the record as to why it's called an official check.
Are there some unofficial checks?
yes, there probably are. I don't know that any have been issued by guaranteed
federal.
That
was a fraud. In the routine, everyday affairs of the state of law, checks, unofficial checks?
I really don't know, Your Honor, but I would assume that the checks that Guaranty Federal uses to pay its rent probably don't say official check, but I'm afraid the record doesn't reflect anything on that issue.
Now, certification of a check is acceptance, correct?
Yes, it is, under the code. This check was not certified, nor was the check in University Savings. In summary, then, on the first issue, I've shown that these petitioners could raise defenses, that Guaranty Federal has raised and proved the real defense of illegality, and that University and Petrolite have raised genuine issues of fact on their defenses. The issue before this court, then, on that question, is whether Guaranty Federal is entitled to judgment and whether University and Petrolite are entitled to a trial. And because of the clear law of this state, we are so entitled, and we are asking for that relief. The second error that I want to address is the order of severance entered by the trial court. As the record reflects, Guaranty Federal brought a third-party action for indemnity after the Horseshoe sued it. That action was severed from the Horseshoe's action and was, we thought, until very recently going to be settled. Unfortunately, the settlement has fallen through recently and the case will probably have to be tried. Now, the important thing about that development from this court's perspective is that it illustrates one aspect of the impropriety of the order of severance. That order, when it rendered the timing of these two cases independent of each other, also rendered Guaranty Federal's ability to meet its indemnity proof uncertain at best. Without a final adjudication in this half of the severed cases, we are unable to fully prove the total number of our damages in indemnity because that number is as yet undetermined. Clearly, the potential prejudice to Guaranty Federal is great now, and it was great at the time the trial court entered its order, and the order should therefore be reversed. There's some mention in the Court of Appeals opinion on that point that Guaranty Federal did not preserve the error on severance. I would point out to the court that our motion for rehearing raised the issue and advised the court that the cases should not be tried separately, and therefore I believe that the point has been adequately preserved for appeal. The third and last point that I want to address is that the summary judgments for respondents were altogether improper here because they didn't meet their burden of proof. They neither attempted to prove nor succeeded in proving that they were holders in due course of these instruments, which is what they had to do after defenses were raised under the code. Now, ICC has basically conceded that issue in its most recent filing with this court, where it says that there are no facts in the record to support its status as a holder in due course. As to the Horseshoe Operating Company, even if Guaranty Federal raised no defenses, the Horseshoe would have had to show that it was a holder of the instrument under the code. It hasn't done that. In order to be a holder of the instrument has to have been negotiated to it under the code. The last endorsement that appears on the check, on the back of the check, is to some entity called the Horseshoe Club Operating Company, which is not the plaintiff here, and we don't know who it is. There's no evidence in the record as to who that entity is. In order to show that it was a holder, the Horseshoe would have had to show either that it was the same entity as the Horseshoe Club Operating Company, or it would have had to show that the Horseshoe Club Operating Company endorse the check to its order or in blank. And it hasn't done that, and there's no evidence in the record about that point. So it isn't a holder, and there's a fact issue on that. Second, on the holder in due course issue, as a matter of law under the Texas gambling cases, the Horseshoe is not a holder in due course. In order to be a holder in due course under 3302, one must give value for an instrument. And the Texas cases in the gambling area say that One who gives gambling chips for an instrument has not given value under the law. Also, in order to be a holder in due course, one must take an instrument without notice of any defenses to it. And the Texas cases further hold that one who takes an instrument in a gambling transaction takes it with notice of defenses, the illegality defense, clearly. Therefore, as a matter of law, the horseshoe is not a holder in due course. On the notice issue, I believe that it really bears remembering that the horseshoe runs a gambling casino in Las Vegas. At least in Texas, probably in other states, gambling casinos have come into courts trying to enforce their gambling debts, and they have been foreclosed from doing so time and again because of state law. Therefore, even apart from the rule that every person is presumed to know the law, I think that we can reasonably conclude that the horseshoe operating company and other gambling casinos have come to learn the law. And they know that they take a very specific risk of non-payment when they take checks like this. The horseshoe knowingly took that risk. In fact, the evidence in the record shows that it was concerned about whether it was going to get paid on this check when it took that check. We are not dealing here with someone who never suspected that it might not collect. We are not dealing here with a commercial holder in due course who is out there just doing business. The horseshoe had excellent reason to suspect that it might not collect on this check, and this court should vindicate its suspicions because that's the law here. In conclusion, there is not a shred of injustice or inequity or even impracticability in any of the code's policies or laws. They are all designed so that the person who should prevail under all applicable legal considerations will prevail. In the meantime, no party will be deprived of valid claims, no party will be deprived of valid defenses. It is only where the court would wrongly dictate that no claims or defenses at all may be raised to instruments like this, which is what the Fifth Court did below, that the risk of eliminating valid and worthy claims and defenses arises. And I think that this court should decline to take that course. For all of these reasons, Guaranty Federal is requesting that judgment be reversed, rendered in its favor, that the horseshoe take nothing, and alternatively, that the case be reversed and remanded for a trial of the remaining fact issues on the horseshoe's claim. University and Petrolife pray that the Court of Appeals be affirmed in their case and that the case be remanded for trial. Thank you for your attention.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the Court, Mr. Nathan Griffin and Mr. James Thompson will present arguments for respondents.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Nathan Griffin of the firm Thomas, Nealon, and Griffin. I'm here this morning on behalf of the respondent, the Horseshoe Operating Company. I will argue this morning the issues concerning whether or not payment can be stopped on the checks that are before this court today. Mr. James Cronzer, representing ICC, will argue the issue of the defenses to the underlying transaction and whether those defenses are available. The issue before this court, I believe, is the nature of the instrument. And it is our contention as respondents that motions for summary judgment were properly granted because the respondents are holders of official, in our case, what's deemed an official check. In the Petrolife case, it's called a teller's check. But we're the holders of those checks, which are analogous to cashier's checks, and as such are not subject to countermand or rescission by the purchaser or the issuing bank.
Let me ask you the same question I asked the petitioners. What difference does that make?
Your Honor, I think it makes a serious difference in this case because if payment cannot be stopped, you cannot raise defenses. Or defenses that they seek to raise, but this court has clearly held in the case of cashier's check that the defenses can't be raised.
The drawee cannot raise defenses, but can the drawer raise defenses?
Well, in a cashier's check, Your Honor, the parties are the same, both drawer and drawee.
But here they're not.
That is correct, Your Honor, but I believe that's a distinction without a difference when we look at the purpose for which these checks are given and the purpose that they're used for.
Well, let me ask you this. If I give you a check and you take it to the bank, and in the meantime I've directed the bank to stop payment on that check, and they do stop payment, and you come into the bank and ask for payment and they refuse it, you still have some recourse against me. Is that true?
That's correct.
And why isn't that also true in this case?
Sure, there's two distinctions, I think, Your Honor. One, that's a, you've given me a personal check. Now, you're a customer of the bank. I have no problem with that definition. But you've given me a personal check, which I've taken to the bank, and you said stop payment, as is your right. What happened in these cases was, I didn't take a personal check, Judge. I took a check that a savings and loan was standing behind, not an individual, but the S&L that sold it, basically, to that individual. And I took that check in reliance upon their promise to pay and their resources. And that's the distinction that the petitioners don't want to hear about. That's the distinction they don't want to make in this case, and that's the reason they want to pay these checks. They want to say, you can depend upon us, but only to a point.
So you're saying that if the drawer of the check is specifically a savings and loan, then that transforms the check into a different kind of instrument?
In the case before the court where there is an executed sale of credit, yes it does, Your Honor.
Why does the UCC not apply to this?
Because, Your Honor, one, when the UCC was adopted, I think prior to the adoption of the Uniform Commercial Code, as evidenced by the highest court in the state of New York, as evidenced by the Supreme Court in the state of Washington, checks of the type before this court, those courts clearly held you couldn't stop payment. They said they're treated as cash, they're executed sales of credit. When the code was drafted, a savings and loan association could not have checking functions. They couldn't draw a check on themselves. That was by federal and state statute. Now that's been changed in the last several years, and they can operate as a bank. I know the court's aware of this. But when the code was drafted, they could not. I don't believe the negotiable instruments law did not have a similar provision similar to 4403 that allowed stop payment. I don't believe the drafters of the code ever thought that this situation would arise where a savings and loan issued what is in essence a cashier's check and then turns around and says, well, simply because, even though it's our money, but it's in another bank, we can stop paying. I don't believe the drafters of the code ever anticipated that, and I believe the courts in the state of Texas, when analyzing negotiable instruments of this type, have taken a correct analysis, with the exception of the Houston court, have taken the correct analysis and viewing these as executed sales of credit. Once they're sold, it's purchased. Once it's sold, the only party that's interested in that instrument is the bank that sold it.
Let me ask you several quick questions.
Certainly.
If I give you a check, I can stop payment on it at any time until it has cleared the bank and the bank has paid.
That's correct.
If the bank has paid it, I can then no longer stop payment on it.
That's correct.
Now, if I go to a bank and purchase a certified check or a cashier's check, there is an immediate offset at the time of purchase of that check against my account. It's not something that takes a matter of days. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, in this particular case, when they bought this official check, was there an immediate offset against guaranteed federal savings and loans?
Your Honor, I can only assume that there was, because you'll note the reason they stopped payment on the check, Mr. Cook didn't quite explain that this morning. The reason they stopped payment on the check was because the remitter in our case returned to Dallas and said, oh, by the way, the check that I gave you yesterday for $2 million was rubber. It's not... There are no funds to back that up. That's why guaranteed stopped payment. But I think, Your Honor, and I'm not a banking expert, I don't know, but I think they debit the account immediately. Why else would they sell him the check?
Well, if they debit the account immediately, then would that not be certification and acceptance?
I think it would, Your Honor. I think it would.
And well, is it your position that if there is an executed sale of credit, then that check is one to which there is no defense by the drawer? For example,
that is correct, Your Honor.
I want to give you a check and you say, well, I don't think I'll want to accept that credit, but I would accept the credit of some large company in which I am able to influence to give you a check drawn on them. Drawn by them. So they give you a check and it's drawn by some person or business whose credit you would accept on some other bank or savings and loan, and you take that check, and then for some reason I do not want that check to be paid, can the drawer refuse to pay that check?
Your Honor, if it is, again, an executed sale of credit, I would say that the drawer would be unable to assert defenses and would be unable to stop the payment.
Whether the drawer is a savings and loan or whatever.
Yes, Your Honor, I think so.
The key term is acceptance, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it is. And I think the distinction that they seek to draw here is a distinction without a difference. The reason people take and accept checks of this kind is because the S&L says, I stand behind this check. Not because Nathan Griffin says, I have this money and I'll be happy to pay you, but because I've gone to the savings and loan or a bank, and I have purchased credit in the form of this check. The fact that their money is in another bank, again, is the distinction without a difference here. The key is, what are these checks used for? Counsel would argue that the public confidence is not going to be affected if they can stop payment on these checks.
Once you have a certified check, even though it contains the name of the maker, it is really no longer the check of the maker, but the check of the bank.
That is absolutely correct. And that's the case we have here. The check before you, I believe we've given you all a handout with a copy of our check, contains the name of the remitter in our case, in the Guarantee case. I don't think the remitter's name is even on the check in the ICC case. But it's not his check. It's the bank's check that you accept.
Counsel, do you agree with the opposing counsel's characterization of one of these checks as ones in which you cannot raise the defenses that are offered under the statute to a check like illegality?
I do, Your Honor, because this court has held clearly that a cashier's check is not subject to those defenses.
This isn't a cashier's check.
Your Honor, but it's the same thing. And the courts in Texas have taken negotiable instruments. They've applied this same reasoning to bank money orders, personal money orders, and I believe the reasoning applies equally as validly to this check that's before us.
If the checks are different, do you lose?
Do I lose, Your Honor?
They're not analogous.
Sir?
If they're not analogous.
If they're not analogous, it's our position that we do not lose because we believe, at least in the horseshoe case, that we can prevail. What we may lose in this case, and this goes back to the argument that commerce is not going to be disrupted. Both of the petitioners in this case have failed. You know, FSLIC has taken over both of them. If these cases go back down and are tried, there's a good possibility that even if we prevail in the same judgment, we're not going to collect it. I don't know what the FSLIC's liability will be in these matters. The key here is how does the public, or one of the keys, how does the public view these checks? Cashier's checks are given, are they not? They're given as cash. And this is a cash equivalent. That's what the courts in this state they've applied that rationale
to. What
bank money orders?
What if the view should change tomorrow? What if they should say tomorrow, well, all these S&Ls are failing left and right. These things aren't any good. Then does the law change and they're not honored anymore?
No, Your Honor, but I don't believe that view is going to change. I think it's imperative for the S&L industry that this court say, yes, these are cash equivalents. What petitioners are asking the court to do is to come in here and to say that, no, these are not cash equivalents. No, the reason that you take these checks, well, you can kind of depend upon them, Mr. Merchant, when I buy my car or my house, Mr. Title Company, but we might stop payment on them. If that's the case, and if that is what this court tells the commercial people in the world, they're going to quit taking those checks.
Isn't the bottom line difference between the two kinds of checks in this context is whether or not the defenses of the illegality can be raised? If they're a cashier's check, it can't be raised. If it's a teller's check, it can be raised.
Well, that would be the petitioner's position, Your Honor. That's right.
That's the petitioner's position. I disagree with it, I'm asking.
Yes, Your Honor, I think so. The difference is simply whether or not a savings and loan as a customer can stop payment because it draws this official check on an account it carries in another bank. There's no question it's not the S&L's fund. It's just simply they're not on site. They're in another bank. And I think that's a distinction here, clearly, without a difference.
Well, but let me be clear now. I don't want to distract you, but let me be clear that if I offer to pay you for something and you say, well, I would rather not take your check, but I'll take Gene Cook's check. And so if you'll get him to give me a check, then I'll take it. So that would be quite understandable. And so I get Judge Cook to give you a check. Now, is that one that if I then say to him, I didn't get what I was promised, I want you to stop payment on that check, that's an executed sale of credit. Why isn't he bound by that check?
Your Honor, I don't know that that's... Is it one, Your Honor, I guess I'm assuming here that you're saying you've given Justice Cook value and he sold you essentially that check, and then you come and give it to me.
Yes,
yes it is an executed sale of credit. I don't think
so.
You can stop payment.
Your Honor. In those circumstances, if I say stop payment on that check, he wouldn't be able to.
That would be my position, Your Honor. I don't know that this court would be willing to extend this case quite that far. But I believe...
But you don't treat Judge Cook any different than a savings and loan.
Well, Your Honor, that's my next... Based on just the tax representations, I don't know that I would have to, Your Honor.
He's probably more solvent than
the... He may be more solvent than both petitioners. Your Honor, I think I would have to treat him a little bit differently.
Well, I think that undercuts your whole argument that we're talking about, that this case has some important policy ramifications as far as commercial lending...
That is exactly correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you one more.
Not yet. we might start looking at you.
Is there any higher form of check that you can purchase from a savings and loan other than an official check?
To my knowledge, there's not.
What is paid to get that check?
Well, consideration passes. I'm assuming that the account is debited immediately, plus in our case, as you'll notice on the application for the official check, there's a $2 charge to obtain the official check. It's just the same thing, Judge, when you look at those documents that we put before you. It's the same thing you'd have when you walk into a bank to buy a cashier's check. The public policy here, I think, is important. The nature and the usage of these checks doesn't favor stopping. These checks of this type are used in transactions every day, in business transactions. If we can stop payment on these checks, then you're going to undermine the public's confidence in an S&L and you'll deprive the check of the character that makes it useful. I don't think there's ever been a time, in our state at least, and maybe in our country, when there was a greater need for public confidence in the savings and loan industry. In Texas in 1988, there were 62 mergers of savings and loan associations. That does not tell us how many S&Ls actually failed. It simply says that many were merged together to try to salvage some of them. Texas led the nation in bank failures in 1987 and 1988. Unprecedented sums of money are being taken out of S&Ls because the public lacks confidence in these institutions. And I think this court is probably well aware, as taxpayers, we're going to bear the brunt of the SSLIC's bailout.
You're not suggesting that this case has caused that crisis, are you?
No, you're not. No. I wish I could, Judge. No. No, I'm not. Certainly I'm not. I'm simply saying that the hold, as petitioners ask this court to hold, is going to further serve to undermine the public's confidence in instruments of this type, and it's going to further damage an already ailing industry. Now, Your Honor, there is one distinction that I need to point out to the court in between the ICC case and our case, and that is that the summary judgment evidence supports our position that this check is analogous to the cashier's check. The check that you have before you looks like a cashier's check. There was evidence, deposition testimony from Mr. David Liner, who was the branch manager of the Guaranty branch that issued this check. When asked what the purpose of an official check was, he said they're used as money orders. Exhibit 6B from his deposition, which is again before you as a computer printout, it makes reference to this check as a money order writer. Exhibit 8 is a copy of a debit credit
transfer of guarantee with the notation stop payment on cashier's check. Harold Rule, who's the vice president in charge of security and regulations compliance for guarantee, testified that this official check could be categorized as a cashier's check. And then the application for the official check shows that there's a $2 charge to purchase the check, a $15 charge for stop payment. And note the conditions for stop payment that guarantee establishes. Either the instrument itself is returned, or all the parties to the instrument sign the stop order. It's undisputed those conditions were not met. But what those conditions tell us is guarantee treats this check like a cashier's check. It's cash as far as guarantee is concerned. The only way they can stop it is either get the thing back, physically back, or have everybody that's a party sign off.
Help me with the history. Are you saying that a savings and loan still does not have a power to draw a check on itself?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. They have full banking functions just as any other bank.
Well, they could issue a cashier's check.
They could issue a cashier's check.
They did not have a power in 1966.
That's correct.
To even do that kind of check.
No, they had the power to issue these types of checks.
In 1966,
they
were doing that.
Certainly. But they did not have that power until sometime in the early 80s.
What power?
To issue checks, draw checks on themselves.
Well, why then, if they had the power to do this kind of check in the 60s, shouldn't the Uniform Commercial Code language be applied? 3305, 3306.
Because I think it was clear that prior to the passage of the code, the court had held that executed sales of credit were the nature of cash, and checks couldn't be stopped. New York, the highest court in New York held that in a case, while it has never been overturned. The Supreme Court of the State of Washington held that. I believe, Your Honor, as the Court of Appeals in Dallas pointed out, there was an old Court of Appeals case here in Texas that reached the same conclusion regarding a bank draft drawn by one bank on another that was given as payment for some fees in a feed store case. And the court there held that you couldn't stop payment on that instrument. Again, using the executed sale of credit rationale and saying that those are the parties that have to be liable on the check. New York has a legal